Welcome to the archives of Radio Curious. I'm Barry Vogel. Interest, attention, and exposure to new ideas can create a whole new world for some children whose life experiences might otherwise be forever limited. The Partnership Scholars Program provides such opportunities. Dr. Glenn Langer, a retired professor of medicine with a specialty in cardiology, created the Partnership Scholars Program. Dr. Langer and his wife decided to use their personal assets to create and develop a mentoring program in one of the poorest neighborhoods near Los Angeles, California. Six of the brightest students from the Lenox Middle School, just east of the Los Angeles International Airport, were selected to receive $8,600 over a six-year period for books, calculators, mentoring expenses, and eventually tuition at private high schools. Dr. Langer's idea to create the Partnership Scholars Program arose not only from the need of these children, but also as a young student, he received financial help that changed his life. In this, the first of two Radio Curious interviews, we visit with Dr. Langer and discuss the Partnership Scholars Program. Later, we talk about heart failure, what it is, and how it may be identified. The second interview will be devoted to further discussions of heart disease. I met with Dr. Langer in the kitchen of his home overlooking the Pacific Ocean in the community of Little River in Mendocino County, California, and asked him to begin by telling us about the Partnership Scholars Program.
The program is called the Partnership Scholars Program. I initiated it when I became involved in volunteering at the UCLA School of Medicine in an outreach program to a school called the Lenox Middle School, which sits just east of the Los Angeles airport. It's the highest poverty area in Los Angeles. It's 96% Hispanic. And I became involved in the volunteering because we were helping them with their science fairs and career day and so on. And the longer I was there, the more I became impressed, number one, with the fact that 2,100 students in this middle school, that there were a number of more talented children who would just fall through the large cracks that exist in our society and would never go on to a higher education and therefore be doomed to careers in life at which it would be impossible to advance and to rise above a fairly minimum level.
How are these students identified?
The teachers recommend them. These students are identified at the beginning of the seventh grade, and so they have a record in the middle school of a year in the middle school and then all the time in the elementary schools.
Is there a knowledge of English a factor?
Yes, it is, and most of our students, many of them are of English as a second language. There is a broad spectrum in that area, but the students are highly motivated, have also strong parental support, that's very important, are all needy, and all have at least a B average.
What does the program provide for them?
The program provides educational enrichment.
Not just in science, but in all areas?
Oh, yes, all areas. This is not limited to science.
Program.
No, not necessarily. I mean, we're going to have a certain number of students who will go on in that area, and that's fine. But no, it's not limited to science at all.
What are some of the enrichment factors?
Yeah. The thing... I have to back up a little bit here, Barry, and tell you that the Lenox School District, as I said, is there just east of the L.A. airport. This is a Miles Square School District. Many of these children who come into our program have never been out of that Miles Square School District. The ocean is only a mile and a half away.
None of them have been to the ocean.
A lot of them haven't been to the ocean. This is a very insular environment, made that way because of the economic level in the area, made that way because many of the children's parents do not speak English, There are a few books in the home. There are certainly no computers. And they operate on a level which is far below that of average in our society.
When you say that the children have a lot of parental support, is there some factor that you're able to identify or tell us about that exists within the families where there is parental support that doesn't exist where there is no parental support?
Yeah, many times the presence of two parents, number one. The absence of drugs or any sort of drug culture in the family among the older siblings, or even in terms of the parents, of alcoholism or whatever, and the clear demonstration that the parents care, their participation in parent-teacher events at the school. And the school recognizes these parents, and this stable family situation is easily recognized in the school, and the teachers know about this, and so we have a lot of information and background on these students.
Who pays for it? Where does the money come
yes.
from?
At the initiation of the program, which the program is now in its fifth year, and 5 years ago, my wife and I initiated the program with seven students. And the commitment for the donor is for a total of 6 years. We provide these scholarships from the seventh grade through the eighth grade and then all the way through high school. The goal is to make these students competitive for entry into a four-year university with scholarship aid. That's our goal.
How long has the program been in existence?
This is our fifth year. We now have, as of now, we have funds contributed or committed for 104 students.
So you're just about to have the first group graduate from high school?
The first group are juniors this year. That's right. And they're, half of them have grade point averages of 4.2 or 4.3. They take a lot of advanced placement. They're just wonderful, wonderful kids. So what we do, just to back up a minute, is this money, this $8,600, which we provide $500 a year in the 7th and 8th grades for use by the student, dispensed by the mentor. They all have one-on-one mentoring, and we provide $200 a year for a mentor's expenses. At the high school level, this increases to $1,500 a year for the student and $300 for the mentor. So the total cost is $8,600 for a student for the total six-year period.
The mentor decides where the money will go?
That's right. And
what are some of the areas where it gets spent?
Yes, well, number one, to go to a bookstore. For many of the students, first time in a bookstore. And I have the description from one of the men. I have volumes of material written to me spontaneously by mentors and the students. But to go to a bookstore and see books 15 shelves high, where a student can go in and select 5 or 8 books to enrich themselves in all that's available there. The student going to a museum, the Getty in Los Angeles, or over to the Huntington, going to Phantom of the Opera, seeing the play, going to UCLA campus, or making a weekend trip, first time any of them have been on an airplane. And the students themselves, the scholars themselves, had to plan the whole itinerary.
And they go with the mentor.
And they go with the mentor.
That's who are the mentors?
The mentors in Los Angeles are the teachers who volunteer their time to do this. They know the students better than anyone. And they are so dedicated and enjoy it so much themselves to see these students enter a new world. It's like planting a seed and watching a flower bloom. It's an incredible thing to watch how rapidly this happens among these students. And so the whole program is directed toward this educational enrichment and expanding their world. Most of them, occasionally you'll find a student have trouble with one subject or another, but academically is usually not a problem. It's just a question of expanding their world and bringing them into the mainstream where they know that they have to take PSATs and SATs and what you need to do to get scholarship aid. Now, the Cal Grant program, which just was voted on in California, which I'm sure you're familiar with, Barry, but will provide tuition to any student with a B average or above and at a certain economic level to any UC or University of California school or Cal State school or any state-supported school. And so it's just a natural for us. Our students are going to be extremely competitive for that program.
You said earlier that the kids who seem to achieve the best in this program are kids from two-parent families where there's little or no drug use or alcoholism. How about kids from a one-parent family where there may be drugs or alcohol more frequently than not?
Yeah. We've had occasion where essentially we've saved our kids. Because of a demonstration that someone cares, that didn't know them, comes from another world, that comes in, the donors or the foundations, and will recognize the fact that this child, that at the seventh grade level, age 12, has a certain amount of talent, has dedication, and it's recognized that this student has done well, frequently will remove that child from the cycle which had been common in that family.
By taking them to another family?
No, by just demonstrating
that there's another way to live.
That there's another way to live and all of the benefits that can come from a persistence and a perseverance and application to achieve a better education.
I'd like you to tell us the background and how you got this idea, but first I want to tell our listeners that this week we're talking again with Dr. Glenn Langer, a retired medical professor from UCLA, who is also the author of a new book called Understanding Disease. You're listening to Radio Curious. I'm Barry Vogel. Glenn, what motivated you to develop this program?
Well, I was a depression kid. I was born in 1928. And between 1932 and halfway through 1935, my father had no work at all. He was out of work for 3.5 years.
Where did you grow up?
I grew up about, all my students nail me right away. They just hear me talk. It's 30 miles north of New York City. I've never lost my New York accent. So what happened to me is that with no money in the family, and I did reasonably well academically through school, and I realized at age 14 I wanted to become a doctor. And I also realized that I didn't have any money.
What was it that happened in your life that made you realize you wanted to become a doctor?
Well, can you believe it? I saw a movie called Spellbound. This is a movie with Ingrid Bergman and Gregory Peck. And Gregory Peck and Ingrid Bergman, these folks were psychiatrists in this movie. And it was, as I said, it was a Hitchcock movie. And it's a 4-star movie, I think 1946. Does that make sense? Let's see, a 14? No, I must have been a little older than 14. Anyway, saw this movie and I became psychiatry looked like the most fascinating thing I had ever seen. And when I left the movie, I said, "That I want to become a psychiatrist." And I didn't know at that time. And I investigated and I found out you had to be an MD to become a psychiatrist. So I started with that as background and decided that I had to go to medical school. So to make a long story short, along the way, the marvelous institution of a National War Memorial Scholarship Program at Colgate University got me all the way through pre-med. And then a family foundation interested in supporting individuals stepped forward and supported all of my medical school education and all of my, all of my postdoctoral education. And I wound up with $100,000 worth of education. Still didn't have any money, but I didn't know anything. If they hadn't stepped forward, I don't know where I'd be today.
Did you pursue psychiatry?
No.
What was the change?
Well, at the time, I got about halfway through medical school. And we began to have our psychiatric courses, and they began to bring in patients, and the psychiatrist would discuss this. Now, at this time, psychiatry was totally abstract.
This was in the early 50s.
Now, this was in the early 50s, and there was no recognition of the chemical basis for manic depression or the chemical basis for schizophrenia or any of that.
In fact, that was a time when electroshock therapy was...
That's exactly
frequent.
Right. Exactly. I was in the Middle Ages. and psychiatry was Freudian, mostly, and psychoanalytic. And as I began to listen to these conferences, there would be six or eight psychiatrists sitting there, and all smoked pipes, so the air was blue with smoke, and everybody was giving an opinion, and nobody could say anything about who was wrong, who was right, or whatever. It was just so loose and so abstract that I began to become disenchanted with that. As if I'd gone through today, it would have been an entirely different story. Psychiatry is changed as much as anything else in the medical science world. So, turned out, at the time I was becoming disenchanted, I took a summer elective with a brilliant cardiologist. And I got hooked, and that's how I wound up in cardiovascular.
Was your experience primarily that as in academics and teaching, or did you have a particular practice?
No, I've been associated with academic medicine all my life, from the time I went through, finished my residency, and finished my fellowship, because I wanted to spend a lot of my time at research, although for 25 years, I saw patients in an academic setting, did a lot of clinical medicine, did a lot of teaching, but wanted to try to develop some new knowledge as well. And that's why I got into research in addition.
Going back to the scholarship program, I was asking you about what motivated you to do it.
Yes. Yes. Well, because of my background, and realizing that if somebody hadn't stepped forward at a relatively early age, I may have gone down one of the cracks. And I saw the talent in these kids, and I saw the dedication of the staff and the teachers. And as a matter of fact, at Lenox, the superintendent there, 2 years after we started this program, he won Superintendent of the Year of the United States of America. I mean, terribly dedicated people. And saw these talented students and thought, gee, we really ought to try to do something with this.
Glenn, is this program limited to the Los Angeles area, or are you widening it to other areas in California and other states, perhaps?
We're widening it. For 3 years, it was limited to not only Los Angeles, but actually the Lenox District, and that was because of lack of funds. We couldn't get support. I approached 30 foundations, and the program was too grassroots, really, for the bigger foundations. They are looking more for global impact.
Where is the program now?
Where is it?
In terms of drawing students and becoming available where mentors may
be. Yeah, where mentor or where funds are available.
Right,
all of those. The program is active at Lenox, and now we have students in the various high schools in the area. Feeding out of Lenox, and we just started two new schools last week in Los Angeles, one in the Mar Vista section and one over in El Monte in East Los Angeles. And we now have also a small program here in Mendocino, starting the Mendocino Middle School, and we have now six students, and we're ready to pick up a couple of more. It's a very small class up here. It's a small middle school, and we have started two students over in Potter Valley. And so we will have 8 or 10, depending on what happens this year, but there are local folks here, donors, contributors, in our area who are funding, some funding three students, some funding one. And so the program is spreading across California.
If a person wants to be a mentor who may be listening to this program, how can they contact you or the program?
Sure, please. Contact me. I'm here in the 707 area, and my number is 937-4917. And if someone, either a mentor or a contributor, or both, we are clearly looking for funds. There are thousands of children who could benefit from this program across the state. And so the only thing that's limiting it are essentially the funding. The mentors we usually can come by. The mentors are very willing to dedicate their time. And we have both a combination of teachers and interested members of the community up here in Northern California.
Would the donations be tax deductible?
Yes, the donations are tax deductible.
What's the name of the group?
The group is the Partnership Scholars Program. We're not a nonprofit. We don't have any. All of the funds go to the student mentor duo. We have no administrative overhead, and the funds are donated directly to the school district. And these school districts are tax exempt entities. The basis of the Internal Revenue Code 170, actually. So the money is entirely tax deductible, and all of it goes for the purpose of the program, educational enrichment. There is no administrative overhead at all.
Glenn, in addition to being the guiding force with you and your wife behind the scholars program, you're somewhat of an expert on the heart, how it works, and why it sometimes doesn't work.
Right.
The phrase heart failure is used in literature, it's used euphemistically, but it's also something that happens.
Correct.
What is it physiologically?
Yeah. Physiologically, heart failure is that condition in which the heart is unable to pump out the blood it receives back from the body. The body circulation is a cycle, and what the heart receives back from all the muscles and organs and so on in the body and the lungs, that amount of blood has to be pumped out, or it's essentially like any situation which has got a pump in line. If the pump doesn't pump out what's coming into the flooded cellar or whatever, then the amount of fluid in the cellar or whatever in the tank is going to increase. And that's what happens in heart failure. What causes that is a defect in the heart muscle, a defect in the pumping ability of the heart muscle. And that can occur for a variety of reasons. It can occur because there's been a heart attack, which removes a lot of the muscle, and you're born with all the heart muscle you will ever have. And so when you lose muscle because it doesn't get blood supply during a heart attack, it dies and is replaced by scar tissue. And so scar tissue doesn't pump. And if the heart attack is extensive enough, you're left with a deficient amount of muscle that cannot fulfill the requirements of pumping out the blood the heart receives. Or you can have a disease of one of the valves of the heart, which produces an increased load. And after a period of anywhere from months to years, that load can induce enlargement of the heart, and it enlarges because it is trying to pick up that load and can do it successfully for a length of time. But at one point, the level of the work required cannot be met by the heart, and therefore you get failure there, or high blood pressure.
So let's talk about high blood pressure.
Sure.
How is it related to a heart that can't manage to move the blood?
Sure. What happens over the years, and hypertension is particularly dangerous because while it is in place, namely the hypertension or high blood pressure, there are frequently no signs. You can have it for many years and not know you have it, unless somebody's put a blood pressure cuff on you and checked it out. What that does is similar to putting a kink in a garden hose. When you put a kink in a garden hose, the pressure required to push the water out of the garden hose goes up. You have to put more pressure in to get past the kink. Well, in hypertension, you've got millions of kinks over out in the circulation in areas of the heart or areas of the circulation where the blood vessels are abnormally constricted, much like kinks in a garden hose. Therefore, the work of the heart to push the blood out into that area has to go up. and the heart enlarges progressively over time, but reaches a limit at which time it will fail to produce, to put out the blood it receives, and therefore we go into heart failure.
And much of this is described in a recent book that you wrote called Understanding Disease, How Your Heart Function and Respond to Treatment.
Right, absolutely. We go into detail, and the book has something we can't do on the radio. It has over 40 illustrations in it, which helps.
Well, in our next program, we'll talk about that book and some specifics about how the heart works and what gets in the way of keeping it from work. But Dr. Glenn Langer, I want to thank you for joining us on Radio Curious. And before we close, I want to ask you to tell us about an interesting book that you've read lately.
I like nonfiction, Barry, and an interesting book, which is now out in paper book, is called The Ship of Gold by a fellow by the name of Gary Kinder. And Ship of Gold describes a ship which was transporting the people and the goods, namely gold, from the California gold fields in 1849. And this ship was sunk off the North Carolina coast in a tremendous hurricane. It lay there for over a century. The book describes not only the whole background of the gold coming on the ship and all the people involved and going around the horn and everything else, but in addition describes the recovery process of the gold, which presented an incredible technical challenge.
When did that occur, the recovery?
The recovery just a few years ago, actually, and it takes through the whole sequence. It takes you through the whole sequence.
Dr. Glenn Langer, thank you for joining us on Radio Curious.
Thank you, Barry. It's been a pleasure.
Dr. Glenn Langer is a retired professor of medicine with a specialty in cardiology. He is the founder, along with his wife, of the Partnership Scholars Program, a program to provide a mentoring program for bright young students who might never otherwise be exposed to further education. The book that Dr. Langer recommends is The Ship of Gold in the Deep Blue Sea, by Gary Kinder. Copies of this and other editions of Radio Curious can be found on our website, www.radiocurious.org. They're also available in CD format for $10 each. At Radio Curious, we appreciate your thoughts and ideas about our programming and enjoy hearing from you. Our address is Post Office Box 7, Ukiah, that's UKIAH, California, 95482. Our email address is curious@radiocurious.org. You've been listening to the archives of Radio Curious. I'm Barry Vogel. Thank you for listening.